couple of brief announcements. First, March 17th, in 2 weeks, bring your artwork, art fair. Display it, come a little early, display it around the room, stay a little later. People can see it. If there's anything, we'll probably play a soundtrack of somebody in the class. If anybody wants to make a poem, that would be a good thing to do also. All right, next week, William Peters is coming next week. Many of you know who he is. He's a local guy who founded the Shared Crossing Project. He helps people with the process of dying. And what I asked him to talk about, I said, this is a class in aliveness. Okay. I think I probably was a good
I'll get your process.
That's a good sign. It means it's alive. So this is a class in aliveness. Would you talk about what difference it makes to your life to have be okay with death? That's some kind of death acceptance. So that does it change how you live to not have that underlying fear? Well, could you talk about that? And he said, yeah. And so I don't know what he's going to come up with, but he's very smart, and I think it might be very interesting to hear that, because many of us know that that's a major issue in our in how we live. You know, that underlying unhappiness with what we think is going to happen. Peter.
Also, he's had two near-death experiences.
Yes. Yeah.
Two.
That's right. And very, very remarkable ones. So he'll say what he's going to say. That's next week, but it'll certainly be interesting. And then the week following that, in 2 weeks, our last class of the term, we're going to do an experience. Most of you have done experiences with me. We, you know, kind of go into a trance and we have an interesting time. So I will give you the thing you're going to write on, the script. But you need to bring a hard surface to write on and also a writing implement. Okay? So remember, in 2 weeks, bring something to write on and write with. Okay, mindfulness for the morning. No, I didn't make the joke. You all kind of know it today. There it is. Because of what we're going to talk about today, in your sitting, it would be good if you could begin to sense this. There's the thoughts that you're entertaining, words and pictures that you're listening to or seeing. There are the feelings that you may be consciously having. There are the sensations coming through your sense organs and from within your body, and you are paying attention to your breathing and softening and opening and breathing and softening and opening. So you're a perspective, right? You're an awareness of these things that are taking place, thoughts, feelings, sensations. You're just watching these things arise and staying with your breathing. So the perspective, the watching, what quality does it have? The one I want to suggest you to pay attention to is a feeling of openness, of spaciousness. It's as though if you're nothing but this infinite open space, space with no boundary. What do you want? Ask me anything. Oh, God. It's a thing that I on here that says, ask me anything. Go. Will you go away?
All right. Pure time. Your email alert.
What?
I think it's your hand.
It's your email alert.
It's my email alert. Okay. I don't have emails. So anyhow, the perspective from which you're watching the thoughts, feelings, and sensations. Examine that, or get a sense for that perspective. And I think what you will find is it doesn't have any border or boundary. It's just an open awareness, an infinite awareness, a field of awareness without limit. And in that field of awareness, there is a breathing happening in the center, and there are these various things that are taking place. But there's a feeling of infinite spaciousness. So thoughts can come and go without impedance, feelings can flow without resistance, sensations can move through this openness, this spaciousness. That's what I want you to focus on. So let's see. I think we need the door. Probably need the doors closed at this point,
and then we'll open them up again.
That'll be good. So we don't get. God knows what will happen. This is happening. Thank you. So the error here would be the usual error that we make. Okay, I'm going to kind of find this feeling of spaciousness. And then you're lost in an elaborate thought, and you really aren't being mindful. So the spaciousness is not something that you find or you make happen. It just happens as you do your mindfulness. And what's the mindfulness? Feel what's moving as you breathe. That's all you're doing. You're just feeling what's moving as you breathe. This moving. What's moving as you breathe? Just keep coming back to that. And as you come back to that, and let yourself soften and open, head, heart, body, soften and open. Then what will happen will be you'll feel your breathing, you'll notice stuff happening, and you'll notice how spacious you become. So it's something that develops. It's not something that you go looking for and create with your mind. So bottom line, feel your breathing, what is moving. Let everything soften and open. And notice whatever you notice. I'll ring the bell in 10 minutes. Well, if you feel a little more relaxed and open than you did 10 minutes ago, that's a start. Let's see. I think I need to move some furniture with Michael's help. Michael, let's move this table right over here. There. Yeah. Good.
Do you have handouts today?
I do, but not until later on.
You have to leave at 20 to 12.
You'll get the handout.
Before then? What?
Before then you'll get it.
Okay,
and let's try with this.
Does this work?
Yeah,
perfect. Is that about right?
I don't use it, but okay, so last week, we looked at the process of becoming enlightened, at least from one perspective, one set of understanding. So that brings up the natural question, what would it like to be enlightened? What would it be like to be enlightened? So this week, I thought I'd talk about life from an enlightened point of view, or at least a more psychologically realized point of view, developed point of view. But what would it be like if you continued your progression toward becoming more conscious? How would that change the way that you look at the world, yourself, and that you live? And this is not a small topic, so I won't do it, comprehensive in my coverage, but I thought I would come at it from just a few different angles to give you a sense that people have talked about this, and that the way that they talk about this is remarkably similar in very different traditions, but there are some differences, and we'll see both those similarities and those differences today. So first, when you think about remember the model I made last week. Unhealthy self to healthy self, Western psychology. Getting us from neurotic or psychotic, or normally neurotic, to healthy. Unhealthy self, or fragmented self, or incomplete or undeveloped self, to developed self. To something beyond self, or a different way of being a self. And that's traditionally been the province of the spiritual traditions. Get us from here to there. So when you think about that, you think about in Western psychology, not very many people have talked about what it would be like to be a fully healthy self, a fully functioning person. Carl Rogers and Abraham Maslow come immediately to mind, the humanistic psychologists. Because humanistic psychology was all about not what's wrong with us and not how we're conditioned by our environment, but how we're human and what our potential is. That gave birth to the human potential movement that many of us are a part of. So, let's see what Abe said, what Abraham Maslow said, a little bit about the very healthy self, about the self-actualizing person. And I have gone into great detail in this class about that, and I will probably at some point in the future, but because I have other things to cover, I'm just going to read a tiny bit of what Maslow said that I think is very central to his point of view, his understanding of that very healthy self. Now this is here, this isn't yet over here. Okay? This is just if you became a self-actualizing person, a fully healthy person, rather than a person struggling with various unresolved issues.
You gave us to us already?
Yeah, about a year ago. I'm not going to go into this in detail. I'm just going to point out one particular section of it. Just to start the discussion off. So this is just a very short part of this much longer article that I did distribute at some point. It's probably on
SWP.org.
Okay, so if you want the whole article, if you want to find out what a fully functioning person's like, what a self-actualizing person's like, just go to SWP.org/Spencer, and there's the whole article, thanks to Robert.
Well, that whole piece.
That whole piece, yeah. Okay, so problem centering. I think I can do this way. Our subjects are general, if you can't hear me, let me know, okay? Otherwise, I'll do it this way and I'll use the microphone later. Our subjects are, in general, strongly focused on problems outside themselves. In current terminology, they're problem-centered rather than ego-centered. They are generally not problems for themselves and are not generally much concerned about themselves. That is, as contrasted with the ordinary introspectiveness that one finds in insecure people. These individuals customarily have some mission in life, some task to fulfill, some problem outside themselves which enlists much of their energy. This is not necessarily a task that they would prefer or choose for themselves. It may be a task that they feel is their responsibility, duty, or obligation. This is why we use the phrase, a task they must do, rather than the phrase, a task they want to do. In general, these tasks are non-personal or unselfish, concerned rather with the good of mankind and humankind in general, or of a nation in general, or of a few individuals in the subject's family. With a few exceptions, we can say that our subjects are ordinarily concerned with basic issues and eternal questions of the type that we have learned to call philosophical or ethical. Such people live customarily in the widest possible frame of reference. They never seem to get so close to the trees that they fail to see the forest. They work within a framework of values that are broad and not petty, universal and not local, and in terms of a century rather than a moment. In a word, these people are all in one sense or another philosophers, however homely. Of course, such an attitude carries with it dozens of implications for every area of daily living. For instance, one of the main presenting symptoms originally worked with, bigness, lack of smallness, triviality, bigness, lack of smallness, triviality, or pettiness can be subsumed under this more general heading. This impression of being above small things, of having a larger horizon, a wider breadth of vision, of living in the widest possible frame of reference, subspecies eternitatis, is of the utmost social and interpersonal importance. It seems to impart a certain serenity and lack of worry over immediate concerns that makes life easier not only for themselves, but for all who are associated with them. So a serenity and lack of worry over immediate concerns and a wider breadth of vision. So Maslow, he's presaging what I'm about to read to you, what we're about to discuss. He correctly understood that this process of growing beyond the small self to something else involves serenity, a lack of immediate worry, and an opening of a wider perspective. So that's the basement of the structure we're setting up. So there are various ways that technologies of going from self to something more evolved, or normal self to something more evolved. The technology that mostly we know about is the spirit, is the spiritual traditions, and there are various roots in the spiritual traditions to go this way. But there's also another technology, which is the technology of using psychoactive agents. And that's been around for a long time in various cultures. In our culture, most recently, it has to do with the use of psychedelics in a guided psychotherapeutic and or spiritual framework. And when you think about that, you think about Stan Grof. And when you think about Stan Grof, you think about his description of the process of going through a death of the smaller sense of self and a rebirth of a larger sense of self, the death-rebirth process, the ego-death process. And originally he researched this as a psychedelic researcher, but then he began to talk to the spiritual people and realized that everybody's talking about the same thing, just different routes to get to the same end. So first we'll talk about what Grof found when he was doing his psychedelic research, and then we'll look at what the spiritual traditions have said about going on the same path. Again, this is nasal irrigation. This is before I come to class. I have to do it, otherwise I have allergies, and if I don't have allergies, I'm happy. If I leak for a while.
Steroids.
This nasal irrigation stuff is just totally great. You know?
So steroids.
Where do you go up here and just go up here and you're all cleaned out. It's great. But you leak for a while. Okay. All right, so one to nine. This is not very long. This is his description. Those of you who know Grof's work, this is his description of BPM-4, Basic Perinatal Matrix 4, when you've gone through the birth process and now you're being delivered. It's the culmination of a great deal of psychological work. It's not something that typically kids that, you know, take a psychedelic and go to parties experience. When they start to even get into these areas, they get really upset and have bad trips, and then they usually don't do it again, or if they do it again, if they have really bad trips, they get hospitalized. And so this is, those of us who have done psychedelic research, you know, and are crusading for it to become a medicine, you kind of don't give dynamite to dynamite. You don't give an extremely powerful thing to people that are very unprepared for that powerful thing. In most cultures, those cultures that use these agents use them in a very prescribed ritual and medicinal way, with a lot of social support and a lot of preparation. So these things, most of us think that these things shouldn't be floating around generally available. They should be supervised in some way, so that people don't get in trouble when the power of these things starts to become apparent. Okay, anyway. A little bit about what happens in the last phase of this death-rebirth process that he talks about. The general atmosphere is that of liberation, redemption, salvation, love, and forgiveness. The individual feels cleansed and purged, as if she has disposed of an incredible amount of garbage, guilt, aggression, and anxiety. She experiences overwhelming love for her fellows, appreciation of warm human relationships, solidarity, and friendship. Such feelings are accompanied by humility and a tendency to engage in service and charitable activities. Irrational and exaggerated ambition, craving for money, status, prestige, or power, appear in this state to be absurd and childish desires. It is difficult to believe that these values were once considered important and were so assiduously pursued. The individual's appreciation of natural beauty is greatly enhanced, and a simple and uncomplicated way of life in close contact with nature appears to be the most desirable mode of existence. The depth and wisdom in systems of thought that advocate this orientation toward life, whether they be Rousseau's philosophy or the teachings of Taoism and Zen Buddhism, seem obvious and unquestionable. In this state, having come through a process of psychological, of clearing out difficulties in the personality, in this state, all the sensory pathways are wide open, and there is an increased sensitivity and enjoyment of the perceptual nuances discovered in the external world. The perception of the environment has a certain primary quality. Every sensory stimulus, be it visual, acoustic, olfactory, gustatory, or tactile, appears to be completely fresh and new, and at the same time, unusually exciting and stimulating. Subjects talk about really seeing the world for the first time in their lives, about discovering entirely new ways of listening to music, and finding endless pleasure in smells and tastes. The individual tuned into this experiential realm usually discovers within, and I'm going to go back to himself. The individual tuned into this experiential realm usually discovers within himself genuinely positive values, such as a sense of justice, appreciation of beauty, feelings of love, self-respect, and respect for others. These values, as well as motivations to pursue them and act in accordance with them, seem to be, on this level, an intrinsic part of the human personality. They cannot be interpreted in psychoanalytic terms as reaction formation to opposite tendencies or as a sublimation of primitive instinctual drives. These higher values seem to be part of the personality, not just a covering over of our animal nature. The individual experiences them without conflict as a natural, logical, and integral part of a higher universal order. In an individual who has completed the death-rebirth sequence and stabilized under the influence of BPM-4, he calls it, rebirth, the feelings of joy and relief are accompanied by deep emotional and physical relaxation, serenity, and tranquility. So that's from Realms of the Human Unconscious, which is his first major work about this. He's written 20-some books. And the popular version of that's The Holotropic Mind, which is what I usually recommend to people, because this is kind of esoteric. This is very easy to read, because he did it with somebody who knows how to write for the popular audience. So just a tiny bit from this. Occasionally, spiritual rebirth can be associated with a very special kind of experience, the Atman-Brahman union described in ancient Hindu texts. Here the person feels a deep connection with the innermost spiritual core of his or her being. The illusion of an individual self, jiva, fades away, and the person enjoys reunion with his or her divine self, Atman, which is also the universal self, Brahman. So the sense of the individual separate self fades, and one enjoys a reunion with his or her divine self, the aspect of yourself which is beyond your individuality, your kind of high transpersonal self, your higher self. And with the universal self, that which is everything that gives birth to these individual aspects of itself. The universal self is also the cosmic source of all existence. This is a direct and immediate contact with the beyond within, with God, or with what the Upanishads refer to as Tat, Svam Asi, thou art that. This realization of the fundamental identity of the individual consciousness with the creative principle of the universe, this realization of the fundamental identity of the individual consciousness with the creative principle of the universe is one of the most profound experiences a human being can have. So we're starting to get into the, we're now into the spiritual traditions which talk about this. So, let's talk about this from a Christian contemplative perspective. This is, thanks to Mary and Gary, this is Cynthia Borgio, who is a Christian contemplative who writes about centering prayer, that some of you may know about and do. This is what Cynthia says.
I think I'll do this for, is this as acceptable as hearing my voice?
Very possible. Very possible.
Yeah. I guess we're getting into the cosmic part of things. Okay. So if I error in how I'm using this, just give me feedback, okay? Because attention, as we normally understand it in the West, is implicitly an energy connecting subject to object. I pay attention to my driving. I pay attention to the lecture, sort of. I pay attention to my breathing. But there is also a different configuration for the attention, in which it does not flow in a straight line, linking subject to object, but can rather hold a certain tensile strength as a three-dimensional field of awareness. The best way I can describe it is through a beautiful metaphor from Rumi, quivering like a drop of mercury. When removed from its container and allowed to organize itself on a flat surface, mercury can act either as a liquid and spread out like a puddle, or it can hold its shape as a drop, rolling around like a weedy, the children's weighted toy that will wobble but won't fall down. A weeble. Your attention is much like that. In its liquid form, it connects subject to object. In its solid weeble form, it's a tensile field of vibratory awareness, within which you can be conscious of the whole without having to split the field into the usual subject-object polarity. It's actually a higher energetic state. The Tibetan Buddhists call it Rigpa, pure awareness. I've come to suspect that the contemplative masters of our own Christian lineage were also well aware of this state, that is actually what is intended by the word vigilance in the Eastern Orthodox tradition and recollection in the West. It doesn't mean thinking deeply about something and recalling it. Rather, it means that you yourself are gathered, recollected, within that deeper inner attentiveness whose much more powerful energetic vibrancy allows a different mode of perception to unfold. Okay, you yourself are recollected within that deeper inner attentiveness whose much more powerful energetic vibrancy allows a different mode of perception to unfold. In the nanosecond between the cessation of one thought and the arising of the next, there is a moment of pure consciousness where subject and object poles drop out and you're simply there. For a nanosecond, there's no you and no God, no experience and no experiencer. There's simply a direct, undivided, sensei awareness of a single, unified field of being perceived from a far deeper place of aliveness. And what is first tasted in a nanosecond can indeed become a stable and integrated state. As the author of The Cloud of Unknowing puts it, you pay attention not to what you are, but to that you are. With all due respect to that author, I might amend that slightly to say that you pay attention from what you are, from the deeper pool of recollected selfhood. There's a deeper current of awareness, a deeper and more intimate sense of belonging, which flows beneath the surface waters of your being and grows stronger and steadier as your attention is able to maintain itself as a unified field of objectless awareness, a spaciousness. You can also get a feeling for this unified field of awareness when you pay attention to your breathing. There's a pause at the bottom of your breath. When your breath has left, there's a fraction of a second or a second before you start breathing in again. In that pause at the bottom of your breath, there's nothing. There's just an open awareness. There's a great stillness and openness. And with practice, you can feel that every time the breath stops before it starts again. You can also feel this open, spacious, unified awareness when you get up in the morning. The very, very, very first thing, instance of coming to consciousness, before you start to think anything. There's simply an open, serene attentiveness, and then it starts to get filled. So that's a Christian contemplative talking about this state that we're investigating. Now let's look at what a Tibetan Buddhist says. Actually, I don't know if this guy's Tibetan Buddhist. I think he's just Buddhist. I don't know which kind of Buddhist. I read this last time, but I'm going to read it again. It's very short. This is Andrew Olensky. Writing in the appendix of the book Mindfulness and Psychotherapy, which some of you may know, really good book. Anyway, here's what the Buddhists say about it, and this is where we start to get a little bit of divergence in the spiritual traditions about what the basis of us is. What's the deepest level of ourselves? But this is the Buddhist idea of anatta, non-self. Ever a source of perplexity, the Buddhist insight of non-self is not denying that there are unique and more or less stable patterns of personality that develop throughout a person's lifetime. You have a personality. Rather, it points out that these patterns are just patterns of conditioning and learned behaviors. They're just stuff you've learned in order to interface with the world and lack any essence or numinous core. Numinous means divine. So these patterns that we call ourself, lack any essence or numinous core. The reflex toward ownership of thoughts, feelings, sensations, and so on, these are mine, this is me, is unwarranted, maladaptive, and the source of a host of psychological difficulties. From the Buddhist point of view, selfing is the problem. You know, you probably heard the person, I don't know who first said it, but no self, no problem. So the Buddhists, when the Buddhists look at it, they don't have a DSM. When they diagnose you because you're having some difficulty, they say two things, or one of two things. They either say you're creating a self and that's what's causing your difficulty, or they're saying you're attached. Let go of attachment. But what's different here than what Cynthia Bourgeau said, and what we're going to read next, is that from the pure Buddhist perspective, when you clean out all these, release all these patterns of selfing, all these patterns of me-ness, then what you find is not a deeper sense of who you are, you find an openness. You find a simple field of awareness without any qualities at all. There is that massive, in Buddhist thought, there are three turnings of the wheel of Dharma. I'm not a real Buddhist scholar, but the three turnings of the wheel of Dharma have to do with the first one being cessation of suffering, that is letting the Buddha taught, letting go of trying to push and pull on the world with that creating suffering. The second turning of the wheel of Dharma, that is a later development in Buddhist thought, is the development of impermanence and non-self, which we just talked about non-self. But the third turning of the wheel of Dharma has to do with Buddha nature, because it was too nothing to have an open nothingness be the core of things. So Buddha nature, which I have no idea what it is, I mean, read about it, but there's something in the nothing. So that might be a reconciliation of traditional Buddhist thought with what we just heard and where we're going, okay? But some of you probably know better than I do, and I don't even know. If I can't experience it, it's just nonsense to me anyway. So. Okay, so now I want to give you something that we're going to read together from as far as we get, and then you have the rest of it to read for yourself. And then I want to show you a video of a rather remarkable young woman who, in her own very different way, says what we're talking about very beautifully. So we'll each get one of these, and then we'll kind of go through it together. Now this one, okay, what I'm going to tell you right now is, so far I've talked about this essence of ourselves, to some extent anyway, from Maslow and the humanistic psychologists, from the psychedelic researchers, from Christian contemplative tradition, from traditional Buddhism. Now I'm going to talk about it from a kind of New Agey perspective, but a sophisticated New Agey perspective. This is an article from the Institute of Noetic Sciences magazine, Shift. But do you understand, as we read this, that this is the same old wine in a New Age bottle that you're going to be reading about? It's a more palatable way to drink the wine than most of us are willing to have the money to.
Maybe there's an increased degree of sophistication that's come through the years that allows us to be able to deal with it now, but we couldn't be.
Yeah, well, when they shove it down your throat, then you can't deal with it. But now that you can elect it, you can kind of look at the same thing. So, Jim, thanks. And Michael, thanks. And I think Remy, you want to do some from the back, and then bring the extras back to me?
Okay.
Yeah. Hundreds of
dollars. Michael, do you have one more? That's two.
Thank you. So take it whatever way you take it. Don't,
but see if you can relate to it and how you can relate to it. And I hope you can do that with everything I've been reading to you. But these are all just people talking about their view of things. I don't care that they have a lineage or they wear robes. I mean, each of us has to do this for ourselves, right? And it's going to come to our own conclusion about this.
This is odd, because Buddhism says nothing has essence.
Yes, that's what I just said. Is there seems to be a dispute at the deepest level here about things. On the other hand, the way that people describe this essence seems to be not so different than what Buddhists describe as the non-essence. They say maybe there's an open awareness is the basis of it. So it's like, is it more of a question of emphasis than of absolute meaning? Okay, so first of all, look at the underneath the title. There's an essential core being that exists beneath, within the overlay of the personality, the very presence of which needs to be acknowledged and revealed to the psyche. The goal for the personality is to become infused with its own essential nature and to become familiar with the experience of its presence and live life with this conscious awareness. There's something deeper than your personality, than who you know you are, that as it comes into your awareness, begins to transform who you are and the way that you live. Essence is the pure, unconditioned nature of who we are, the purest fiber of our being. It is more fundamental and intrinsic than our personality. Essence is that which cannot be reduced or removed. It is always present, always available, and always rising in us. It is a permanent, abiding presence. Its basic quality is its existence as an ontological, as basic actuality, a suchness. Essence is the pure and authentic presence of our being. Its presence is its primary action. That is, it's there, it's here. Essence is our true nature. It is being without the distortion of our personal history. These next four things I do not understand. Essence isn't alive, it is aliveness. Essence isn't aware, it is awareness. Essence isn't loving, it is love. Essence isn't being true, it is truth. So I think what she's saying is, it's not that these things are part of something. These things are the pure form. It's not that you partake of love. It's that essence is love itself. Something like that. Okay, so person.
Essence isn't an activity.
Yeah, right.
She's saying essence is not an activity that we.
Yes, it's
something that's an ideal underlying.
Yes, activity. It's a platonic pure form. Yes. It's not something that you do. Yeah, that's a good way to say it, Carl. Thank you. Personality versus truth. When essence expresses itself into our lives on a personal level, it manifests as various experiential qualities that are clearly discernible. That is, when essence comes into us as a personality, it comes in this way, such as the warmth of compassion, the sweetness of love, the stillness of peace, the solidity of will, and the fire of strength. These qualities and others, in their purest form, are our potential. They are the essential qualities of our being. However, even though essence and the essential qualities are always there and always available to us, as we live through life's experiences and become wounded in various ways, we end up abandoning them and losing awareness of their presence. We forget how to access them. We get defended, we get covered over, and we lose these qualities. When we lose contact with the experience and presence of our essence and its essential qualities, we literally feel a hole or emptiness or deficiency in ourselves. And many people talk about that before they come into therapy or they go into spiritual practice, because they feel like there's something missing. Like they go into the core of themselves and there's a black hole where there should be something, there's nothing. And that's a palpable sense that people have. Most often this is frightening and painful. One of the characteristics of the ego personality is that it feels it must compensate for this loss. It feels it must and can substitute for it. There's a kind of ego pride in its our ability to do this for ourselves, and it does its best to provide what is needed to ease the pain and fill the hole with deficiency. The ego feels it can create its own strength, its own love, its own security, whatever it needs. However, the compensations that it uses only mimic the essential qualities, and rather than originating from essence, they're rooted in a defensive avoidance of life's pain. So they're an attempt to reconstruct on an ego level that which properly comes from beyond. So they're a feeble attempt. Each time that people compensate for an essential quality, they're actually distancing themselves from the experience of their essential nature and from the truth of who they truly are. Living our lives and identifying ourselves solely as a personality, relegates us to live within the confines of the nature of the personality, which can be a deficient whole, vacant of authentic experience. The kind of person we try to be to compensate for our lack is not who we truly are. We're a simulacrum of what is actually who we are. We fake it. Essence is a presence that exists purely as itself. It has nothing to do with the identifications and compensations of the personality. However, it's very important to know the flow of essence into our lives is structured and experienced by either the spin of our personality or by the recognition of our essential being. That is, some people take these qualities and they own them. It's me. Other people realize it's something larger than they are that they are representing. It is who we think we are, what we identify with, that influences the quality of our experience of essence as it flows into our life, and whether or not we're even aware of its presence. If we are strongly identified with our personality, we won't easily recognize essence and its qualities when it presents to us. As we awaken to this knowing, we're free to become aware of the subtle realms of self, capital S self, and discover more of who we are. We can inquire further into what comprises us, our personality, our essential core, and open to the experience of the complexity of our being.
She lost me.
She says, if I can kind of paraphrase, what she said is, if you recognize that what's the deepest in you is something beyond who you are, and you become a conduit for that deeper love understanding, then you develop in a healthy way. But if you think that that's something you created for yourself, then you misunderstand it and can get distorted. I think that I'm going to leave you to read the rest of this for yourself, because I want to have enough time to
I've got just one question.
Yeah.
Is it unique?
Say it.
Essence. Is it unique or it's common?
No, it's common. It's the core of everything. It's the core of everything. And each of us experiences it in a unique way, which is why we're unique individuals. Anything else I want to tell you? No. I'll let you read the rest of this for yourself. If we have a couple minutes at the end, we might go back to it. But I want to show you this, okay? Because I think
very didactic, and you've been reading and you've been focusing very well. Let's watch a little bit of video of a rather remarkable person talking about her growth.
If you get, yeah, if you close everything up.
It'll be loud at the very beginning. They always have that alarming.
Embracing otherness. When I first heard this theme, I thought, well, embracing otherness is embracing myself. And the journey to that place of understanding and acceptance has been an interesting one for me. And it's given me an insight into the whole notion of self, which I think is worth sharing with you today. We each have a self, but I don't think that we're born with one. You know how newborn babies believe they're part of everything, they're not separate. Well, that fundamental sense of oneness is lost on us very quickly. It's like that initial stage is over. Oneness, infancy, unformed, primitive. It's no longer valid or real. What is real is separateness. And at some point in early babyhood, the idea of self starts to form. Our little portion of oneness is given a name, is told all kinds of things about itself. And these details, opinions, and ideas become facts, which go towards building ourselves, our identity. And that self becomes the vehicle for navigating our social world. But the self is a projection based on other people's projections. Is it who we really are? Or who we really want to be, or should be. So this whole interaction with self and identity was a very difficult one for me growing up. The self that I attempted to take out into the world was rejected over and over again. And my panic at not having a self that fit, and the confusion that came from myself being rejected, created anxiety, shame, and hopelessness, which kind of defined me for a long time. But in retrospect, the destruction of myself was so repetitive that I started to see a pattern. The self changed, got affected, broken, destroyed, but another one would evolve. Sometimes stronger, sometimes hateful, sometimes not wanting to be there at all. The self was not constant. And how many times would myself have to die before I realized that it was never alive in the first place? I grew up on the coast of England in the 70s. My dad is white from Cornwall, and my mom is black from Zimbabwe. Even the idea of us as a family was challenging to most people. But nature had its wicked way and brown babies were born. But from about the age of 5, I was aware that I didn't fit. I was the black atheist kid in the all-white Catholic school run by nuns. I was an anomaly. And myself was rooting around for definition, trying to plug in. Because the self likes to fit, to see itself replicated, to belong. That confirms its existence and its importance. And it is important. It has an extremely important function. Without it, we literally can't interface with others. We can't hatch plans and climb that stairway of popularity, of success. But my skin color wasn't right. My hair wasn't right. My history wasn't right. Myself became defined by otherness, which meant that in that social world, I didn't really exist. And I was other before being anything else, even before being a girl. I was a noticeable nobody. Another world was opening up around this time, performance and dancing. That nagging dread of selfhood didn't exist when I was dancing. I'd literally lose myself. And I was a really good dancer. I would put all my emotional expression into my dancing. I could be in the movement in a way that I wasn't able to be in my real life, in myself. And at 16, I stumbled across another opportunity and I earned my first acting role in a film. I can hardly find the words to describe the peace I felt when I was acting. My dysfunctional self could actually plug in to another self, not my own, and it felt so good. It was the first time that I existed inside a fully functioning self, one that I controlled, that I steered, that I gave life to. But the shooting day would end, and I'd return to my gnarly, awkward self. By 19, I was a fully-fledged movie actor, but still searching for definition. I applied to read anthropology at university. Dr. Phyllis Lee gave me my interview, and she asked me, how would you define race? Well, I thought I had the answer to that one. And I said, skin color. So biology, genetics, she said. Because, Tandy, that's not accurate, because there's actually more genetic difference between a black Kenyan and a black Ugandan than there is between a black Kenyan and, say, a white Norwegian. Because we all stem from Africa, so in Africa, there's been more time to create genetic diversity. In other words, race has no basis in biological or scientific fact. On the one hand, result, right? On the other hand, my definition of self just lost a huge chunk of its credibility. But what was credible, what is biological and scientific fact, is that we all stem from Africa. In fact, from a woman called Mitochondrial Eve, who lived 160,000 years ago. And race is an illegitimate concept which ourselves have created based on fear and ignorance. Strangely, these revelations didn't cure my low self-esteem. That feeling of otherness, my desire to disappear, was still very powerful. I had a degree from Cambridge. I had a thriving career, but myself was a car crash. And I wound up with bulimia and on a therapist's couch. And of course I did. I still believed myself was all I was. I still valued self-worth above all other worth. And what was there to suggest otherwise? We've created entire value systems and a physical reality to support the worth of self. Look at the industry for self-image and the jobs it creates, the revenue it turns over. right in assuming that the self is an actual living thing, but it's not. It's a projection which our clever brains create in order to cheat ourselves from the reality of death. But there is something that can give the self ultimate and infinite connection. And that thing is oneness, our essence. The self's struggle for authenticity and definition will never end unless it's connected to its creator, to you, and to me. And that can happen with awareness. Awareness of the reality of oneness and the projection of selfhood. For a start, we can think about all the times when we do lose ourselves. It happens when I dance, when I'm acting. I'm earthed in my essence, and myself is suspended. In those moments, I'm connected to everything. The ground, the air, the sounds, the energy from the audience. All my senses are alert and alive. In much the same way as an infant might feel, that feeling of oneness. And when I'm acting a role, I inhabit another self, and I give it life for a while. Because when the self is suspended, so is divisiveness and judgment. And I play everything from vengeful ghost in the time of slavery to Secretary of State in 2004. And no matter how other these selves might be, they're all related in me. And I honestly believe the key to my success as an actor and my progress as a person has been the very lack of self that used to make me feel so anxious and insecure. I always wondered why I could feel others' pain so deeply, why I could recognize this somebody in the nobody. It's because I didn't have a self to get in the way. I thought I lacked substance. And the fact that I could feel others meant that I had nothing of myself to feel. The thing that was a source of shame was actually a source of enlightenment. And when I realized and really understood that myself is a projection and that it has a function, a funny thing happened. I stopped giving it so much authority. I give it its due. I take it to therapy. I've become very familiar with its dysfunctional behavior. But I'm not ashamed of myself. In fact, I respect myself and its function. And over time, and with practice, I've tried to live more and more from my essence. And if you can do that, incredible things happen. I was in Congo in February, dancing and celebrating with women who've survived the destruction of their selves in literally unthinkable ways. Destroyed because other brutalized, psychopathic selves all over that beautiful land are fueling ourselves' addiction to iPods, pads, and bling, which further disconnect ourselves from ever feeling their pain, their suffering, their death. Because hey, if we're all living in ourselves and mistaking it for life, then we're devaluing and desensitizing life. And in that disconnected state, yeah, we can build factory farms with no windows, destroy marine life, and use rape as a weapon of war. So here's a note to self. The cracks have started to show in our constructed world, and oceans will continue to surge through the cracks, and oil, and blood, rivers of it. Crucially, we haven't been figuring out how to live in oneness with the earth and every other living thing. We've just been insanely trying to figure out how to live with each other, billions of each other. Only we're not living with each other. Our crazy selves are living with each other and perpetuating an epidemic of disconnection. Let's live with each other and take it a breath at a time. If we can get under that heavy self, light a torch of awareness, and find our essence, our connection to the infinite and every other living thing. We knew it from the day we were born. Let's not be freaked out by our bountiful nothingness. It's more a reality than the ones ourselves have created. Imagine what kind of existence we can have if we honor inevitable death of self, appreciate the privilege of life, and marvel at what comes next. Simple awareness is where it begins. Thank you for listening.
So that's Tandy Newton, whom some of you have seen acting. That's a pretty remarkable talk, huh?
Yes.
Newton is her last name, Isaac Newton. Tandy.
T-H-A-N-D-I-E.
T-H-A-N-D-I-E, Newton, N-E-W-T-O-N. And she kind of says what we've been talking about incredibly well. Let's talk just a little bit. What I want to leave you with, and do read the rest of this, because she talks about how you get back to it. You have to kind of soften the structures of your personality so you can see underneath it, you know, and pay it. Well, all right. What she says in a nutshell is how you get back to self, essence from self, from being caught up in self. She says you watch the self and you let it soften and open, and you, instead of being drawn into the drama of the self, you just remain aware of it, and you remain aware of how that drama unfolds and what keeps coming up for you moment by moment. And there's a process, an alchemical process, she says, of kind of dissolving these patterns of defense and more being in touch with that which is underneath them. That makes sense? With your vulnerability, with your essence, with your oneness, with your undefended being. And that's what she says in very beautiful terms, and that's what she says, too. Dual with awareness. So that's what we're doing, right? Okay. So, Gordon.
I've been reading a book by Paul Brunt and on the short path with enlightenment, and he has some really interesting ideas on how to become it. Define your essence.
Okay, so
I recommend it for anybody.
Say his name and I will yell it out.
Paul Brunton. Paul Brunton.
B-R-O-U-T-O-N,
I think. Brunton.
Okay, Paul Brunton.
B-R-O-U-T-O-N.
O-U-T-O-N.
He was writing back in the 30s. He wrote a book called Our Secret Search in India, My Secret Search in India. And he's a really interesting guy. He's got some great ideas. I keep coming back to that book all the time.
Gordon, will you bring it next week and put it on the table so people can see it if they want to go get it? Don't take his book. Just look at it, okay? Put it out there. Otherwise, you'll have to pay for another one. Okay, so Abraham.
What's the title of the book again?
What's the title? Do you remember? Wait. What's the title of the book?
The Short Path to Enlightenment.
A Short Path to Enlightenment. You should be able to Google it and find it.
It's on Amazon.
Okay, so... when Gordon recommends something, pay attention to it. Gordon has been doing this for a while.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay, so Abraham.
I'm talking about personal experience, you know, that I found that we lost the self-worth that we were born with. And then we struggled through life without realizing our self-worth. But when I went back and thought about my self-worth, I started connected to my true self, because self-worth is not given. You cannot get it anywhere. You were born with it. You just have to realize it, that you have it. And then that self-worth, when I got into my true self, I found that it's easier to connect with others. So this is my own personal experience, which I'm surprised that, you know, she, like that article and her, never went into self-worth.
It's a good addendum to that, because it's not a question of not having a self. It's a question of having a self that is concentric with the what is brings it forth, what is underneath it. So the idea is not to walk around, you know, without an interface with the world, without a defend, you know, without a structure to deal with the world. It's to have a structure to deal with the world that is creates a harmony, that comes from harmony and creates harmony. The other thing that Abraham said that I want to emphasize is this is a recollective process. This is a process of remembering things which were forgotten in the hue and cry of growing up. Maybe one more person. Anybody want to say anything? Betsy? Oh, two more people. Betsy and then Richard.
I was just going to say,
laugh.
Because I teach awareness through movement, the Feldenkrais method, the nice thing about trying something like that for a person is that it brings you back to your essence right away. And so it's a way to experience it on a sensual basis.
Let me underline that. More and more we're finding, those of us who do therapeutic work are finding that the somatic work, which is a way to kind of come pretty quickly back through all that crap. So Betsy does that immediately. She shows you how to live in a way that is more easier to live, more harmonious way to live, right? More connected and fluid way to live.
That self-non-self.
And so you're not stuck in dysfunction. Richard?
I'm just going to say, as a creative person, I always relate to the fact that, you know, when I create music, I don't feel it's coming. I feel like I'm a channel for it, so it's not about me doing it, it's me getting myself out of the way so that the stuff can come through and I can capture it. As long as it's flowing through me. And that's the most incredible feeling, because there's no sense of self-awareness. It's just you being this channel. And you just light up because you know you feel the energy going through you.
So many of you have heard that. That's the definition, what he just said is the definition of the flow state. When you're not there, it just, something larger moves through you, and your function is to just have been skilled enough to be able to bring that into being. So you're a conduit, a skilled conduit. And that's what I just taught a class on that last night, the flow in my Csikszentmihalyi. What you said is exactly how he started that flow talk off. He said, this is a famous composer. This composer says, it just comes through me. I watch my hand move, and I don't know who's moving it.
Figure out ways to get yourself out of the way, because you want to be distracted, and yourself wants to be distracted there, because it's giving up itself by, you know, by getting into that space. So you'll try to figure out everything else you can do, and then finally you surrender, and then it starts to come through, and then you just try to document as much as you can before the flow stops.
So there's two things about the surrendering. It's a surrender process to something larger. And secondly, Eckhart Tolle talks about the ego not wanting to die, you know, not wanting to give itself up. So why don't we go outside now? Why don't we make a phone call now? Because there's a surrender that of this small sense of self that has to happen. And that's what has to happen in relationship, unfortunately. No, unfortunately. But the point is, you know, that's the problem in a relationship. You stay stuck in yourself. And the relationship is hard because you have to keep surrendering to something larger than yourself. So there's one more comment. Okay, so Peter, you got the last.
In terms of surrendering to yourself, I find that using hypnosis, the relaxation and the connection with something greater than yourself, it can be
produced through hypnosis can be another way to get out of the way and connect with your true essence.
So I totally second that. Peter is a very accomplished and well-known hypnotherapist. And it's an amazing shortcut that or an amazing conduit to this larger understanding that everybody should know, but they don't. All right, so let's wait for that. Do finish reading that article. It's well phrased throughout the whole thing. And next week when we come back, we'll see what William Peters can teach us about the small self and the large self, or the small self and something larger. See you next week.